Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Luis Buñuel, the surrealist provocateur. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 20 minutes. Luis Buñuel. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. After Fellini's parades and memory palaces, we step into rooms where logic keeps its hat politely in its lap and desire rearranges the furniture. The doors open and sometimes will not let the guests out. A dinner is prepared and never happens. A bishop serves a mass with hands that tremble with hunger and then discovers that the god he serves has a sense of humor colder than marble. If other directors have begged rationality to explain itself, Luis Buñuel smiles and lets it confess by misbehaving. He is the filmmaker who slid an eye, not yours, not mine, a woman in a black and white frame, and made audiences feel the slice on their own corneas. The man who took a cow to bed and ants out of a palm and then, for half a century, kept lying with the straightest face you have ever seen in a cinema. He changed how we see the world by restoring to images their right to dream, and then to hurt. He was born in 1900 in Calanda, in Aragon, where drums are not instruments but weather. Easter processions drove rhythm into the day. Catholicism placed pictures in his head that would later reappear with the paint rearranged. A Jesuit education taught him how authority sounds when it is certain and how certainty looks when it is cornered. He landed in Madrid as Spain tried to rehearse modernity and fell into the residence of students where Lorca read poems out loud in a voice that made vowels carry dust and Dali drew faces that saw your embarrassment a second before you did. They were a company of friends and frictions. Theater and painting and arguments about how much of the world can be explained by manners. Paris called, surrealism opened a door. He did not become a good soldier in André Breton's army. He was too stubborn. But for a season he was delighted to discover a group willing to make laboratories out of dreams. He met poverty in Paris and a breed of freedom that looks like hunger. In 1929 he made, with Dali, Un Chien Analu, a short that arrived with a manifesto disguised as mischief. No idea or image that might lend itself to a rational explanation of any kind was accepted. They promised each other, and then they did something even more dangerous. They designed their irrationality. The opening, Buñuel himself playing the man with the razor, a cloud crossing the moon like a lid over an eye, a woman's eye sliced so cleanly that the cut made audiences blink half a century later when Vitus reintroduced them to the crime, was not a scandal for scandal's sake. It was a declaration of war against the illusion that respectability keeps harm out of the room. Ants flood from a hand. Priests at one moment become luggage. The rules of continuity are respected just long enough to be broken strategically. The effect is less confusion than a private recognition. Your mind dreams like this when you are honest. He and Dali followed with L'Age d'Or, a feature-length continuation that ends with a parody of Christ and a Marquis de Sade echo, and the Paris of policemen, patrons, and piety stopped pretending to laugh. There were riots. The film was banned. Investors hid. Surrealists argued, the church took notes. Buñuel did not apologize. He went to work. He served a spell at the Museum of Modern Art in New York learning how the projector operates and then returned to Spain to make Las Huts, Land Without Bread, a documentary so dry that it chafes. The region is poor. The voiceover is ironical. The camera records without sentiment and with cruelty. Goat, cliff, child, bread, each receives the same tone. He was accused of lying because he did not pretend to be innocent. Later he would say that the film contains its own alibi. When reality is intolerable, the first duty is not to decorate it. Exile is not a metaphor in his story. Civil war arrived in Spain and then the long regime. He left, circled, took a post at the Museum of Modern Art that ended badly, arrived in Mexico and for years, worked like a man who owes money to someone he respects. The Mexican period made him, not the shock of the avant-garde he had been, but a craftsman who could build a melodrama and then install, inside it, a ticking device. Los Olvidados puts slum boys on screen without asking pity to be polite. Its dream sequences are not relief but prophecy. An egg smashed on a screen, a chunk of meat thrown and then transformed, a mother's disgust. These are not symbols. They are stenography from a room where money has learned how to humiliate. People called the film cruel. The film called the world careless. In El, a devout man's jealousy becomes an architecture. In Ensayo de un Crimen, the criminal life of Arcibaldo de la Cruz, a music box becomes an accessory before the fact. In Nazarin, a priest tries to live the gospel among beggars and finds that holiness confuses the poor and enrages the police. Bunuel's tone throughout is the deadpan of a witness who will not sign your petition and will not refuse to testify. Return to Europe comes with scandal, as if scandal were an old friend who rented an apartment across the hall. Viridian introduces a young novice whose uncle desires her under the banner of etiquette. Banquet, rope, a tableau vivant of the Last Supper that lasts long enough for an audience to decide whether it will blush or turn away. Spain banned it, the Vatican called it blasphemous, King gave it a prize. Bunuel, in interviews, kept his voice level. The film is not a screed, it is a composure. A pious woman's charity becomes an instrument for other people's appetites. Her dignity survives, damaged, and the film insists that survival is not a sin. The 1960s give him budgets and mischief in equal measure. The exterminating angel invites a dinner party that cannot leave the room after the meal. There is no visible lock. The first attempt to exit fails, excuses are made, night falls, the servants escape by obeying a social instinct the masters can no longer remember how to access, days pass, hunger and rancor and revelation. A lamb wanders in, a murder almost happens, a confession does. The fleeing guests go to church to give thanks and discover that the church shares the disease of their house. The brilliant cruelty of the film is that it never explains the cause. It isn't a puzzle, it's a diagnosis. Bunuel understood that constraint is sometimes structural and sometimes chosen. The guests, stripped of coat and phone and status, discover that habit can be stronger than hunger. He made, in one gag filled with corpses and roses, the best lesson plan extant on how rituals teach us to accept our cages. His 1964 Diary of a Chambermaid puts Jean Moreau in a house where class is the stage and secrets play for keeps. In Belle de Jour, he gives Catherine Deneuve afternoon hours in a brothel because her marriage is a quiet where desire cannot survive. The film is not the pornography some viewers hoped for, it is anatomy. The images, coffin, mud, a client carrying boxes with something inside, a bell that rings inside the mind, are arranged with the rigor of a surgeon. The fantasies do not explain, they expose. He refuses to punish the woman who experiments with freedom. He refuses to free her from consequence. The calm is infuriating to the moralist and reassuring to the adult. In the 1970s, he and Jean-Claude Carrière wrote a suite of films whose titles are punchlines. The discreet charm of the bourgeoisie sends six friends chasing a meal that keeps being postponed by death, revolution, a military exercise, theater, and their own delicacy. The connective tissue is a road with walkers on it. The dinner guests between dinners, moving through a landscape that refuses to turn into a destination. The dreams nested inside the film keep revealing who is deceiving whom. Confessions turn out to be rehearsals for confessions inside a dream. At one point, a curtain rises and the diners discover they are on a stage and cannot remember their lines. The Phantom of Liberty arranges sketches where social customs are inverted until they confess their absurdity. People sit on toilets at a formal table and sneak into a side room to eat privately. A little girl goes missing and remains present. Police chase anarchists and then miss the point. The film ends with a stock shot of an ostrich staring at you as if you had asked the wrong questions all afternoon. That obscure object of desire ends the career with a repetition. Two different actresses, Carol Bouquet and Angela Molina, play one woman, and the suitor who narrates his frustrations does not notice the swap because desire sees what it needs to see. A burlap sack recurs. A bomb explodes. The world continues as if explosions were punctuation. The film records fatigue without contempt. Two habits organize all this mischief into a method. The first is the refusal to flatter explanation. Bunuel keeps the surface of scenes calm, the camera often still, the cutting patient, so that an audience cannot mistake momentum for meaning. Sound detaches from image to expose the lie, a solemn mass over a scene of cruelty, a bird's chirping in a room where nothing grows, a shot fired and no one flinches because the real violence already happened when the invitation was sent. Because the direction is unshowy, no visual shout for attention. Absurdity arrives with the authority we normally assign to factual statements. The second habit is kindness for the scapegoat, which is not the same as innocence. His priests are often ridiculous. His beggars sometimes mean. His women stubborn and sane. His men ridiculous with an intensity that would be funny if it were not dangerous. The equalizing device is appetite. Everyone wants, The question is who invented permission to want without harm. The Catholic material is not a face. It is the grammar. He loved ritual and distrusted its seductions. He took confession seriously enough to defend its capacity to heal and distrusted its utility as a performance. He populated films with clergy not to denounce God but to embarrass the human habit of deputizing heaven to excuse cruelty. "Thank God I am an atheist," he joked, and the joke works because it contains two forms of love. For the God he cannot believe in, for the human beings who cannot help themselves from using that God as a mirror. If you flinch at blasphemy, his films will welcome your flinch and teach you to inspect what it protects. A Bunuel set was famously practical. He storyboarded meticulously and shot quickly. He disliked improvisation when it lied. He preferred non-professional faces when the story belonged to the street and majors when the story required the glamour that would later be corrected by the film. He poured drink in moderation and kept lunch punctual. He loved insects, their purposefulness, their indifference, and would allow them to cross a shot because truth needs harmless intrusions. He trusted Carrière the way a poet trusts a prosodist. Together they cut scripts until jokes could survive winter. He respected producers who protected him from committees and granted them the pleasure of coming to set to find a day ahead of schedule. The mischief, in other words, was supported by temperance. He also wrote, near the end of his life, My Last Sigh, a book whose voice matches the film's. Courteous, impish, purposeful, occasionally savage to hypocrisy and oddly protective of embarrassed truths. He recorded dreams on note cards at breakfast. He made a list of what he loved and loathed and allowed both lists to assist him in choosing images. He remained in love with food and wine as if appetite were not the enemy of art but its mother tongue. He did not pretend that the surrealist wars had matured into some serene clarity. He acknowledged they had ripened into craft. He took the trouble to speak plainly about technique, how to place a camera so that a miracle looks like an event rather than a special effect, how to time a pause so that politeness becomes a symptom, how to end a scene before a sigh because a sigh is vanity. What, besides the pleasure of being astonished without being lied to, can we carry from him into work that must be done tomorrow? Begin with the practice of deliberate incongruity. Bunuel discovers what a habit is by making it collide with itself. In a meeting that might mean asking each person to recite the rule they secretly obey and then staging a conversation where those rules contradict each other until the contradiction becomes visible. In policy, it might mean putting two procedures back to back that were designed to solve different problems and asking where they quietly sabotage each other. In a relationship, it might mean narrating kindly how a ritual meant to create intimacy has come to be a revenue stream for fear. He teaches that incongruity, administered with precision, is an instrument of truth. Next, practice opaque causality. In The Exterminating Angel, the cause is never named, the effect dominates. In life, we often waste months seeking a clean cause where a tangle of habits is the real jailer. When a team keeps repeating a mistake though the process chart shows no flaw, do not rewrite the chart. Throw a dinner and disallow the one unspoken etiquette that keeps the elite at the table and the apprentices at the kitchen door. See what breaks. When your household cannot seem to leave for school on time, forbid one object, say phones, in the last 10 minutes and see what law the panic reveals. Naming a cause after the fact is Bunuel's smallest vice. Rearranging the room so that responsibility is no longer a rumor is his strength. Then learn the discipline of deadpan. His tone is not cruelty, it is anesthesia withheld. In places where an organization's noise disguises harm, emails, dashboards, slogans, strip the voice to repertorial calm. We say we value X. Today we chose Y. Here is who paid. No scolding, the absurdity emerges without your help. This is the Bunuel cut, quiet and blunt. Try it carefully, it becomes a culture when repeated. Practice ritual audits. Pick one ritual you inherit, weekly status, morning stand-up, quarterly objectives, and subject it to the Bunuel test. Does it prevent the meal from being eaten? If so, reduce it until it passes food. In the home, audit bedtime, holiday, apology. Remove the lines that turn love into a formality. If the ritual is essential, mass, oath, safety check. Restore it to meaning by taking away every flourish that allows a liar to pass without sweating. He would have been a good compliance officer. He would have been the worst possible one for lazy managers. Finally, keep a dream ledger you actually use. Do not romanticize it. Use it as a diagnostic, What recurs? Which faces arrive when your guard is down? What does your mind do when you refuse to explain yourself? A director uses such notes to stage. A leader uses them to notice which problems their language never seems to reach. A parent uses them to discover which scene in the house keeps repeating. Bunuel's ethics are simple. The mind is not a ministry spokesperson for the soul. It is a department of transportation. If the same truck keeps crossing the same bridge in the dark, build a toll booth there or widen the span. But first, write down where it squeaks. Why does his method still feel contemporary when so much contemporary culture is already surreal? Precisely because he does not use strangeness as decor. He uses it to make the ordinary audible. The dinner table is a room where class and hunger meet. Refuse to let the food arrive and everyone's true formal education appears. A bishop disguised as a gardener learns that service is a better theology than hierarchy the minute you remove the costume. A woman's erotic life, shamed by a polite marriage, becomes visible when she chooses honesty over performance and then must live with the bills desire sends. A political rally, filmed with an ear for the drum and an eye for the faces that resist the chant, reveals not a platform but a rhythm people wished would make choices for them. He restores agency not by cheering it but by showing what kills it. For artists, the craft notations are portable. Cut a scene a beat early and let the audience perform the sigh. Place a camera at eye level and then, when ritual takes over, drop it a few inches so the room looks taller than the people speaking. Let a sound continue across a cut to explain that the thought has not finished though the shot has. Borrow his plain light until your image can bear fancy. When you stage a blasphemy, refuse to laugh. Insist that offense be earned, not borrowed. When you direct actors, ask them to do without explaining. In the absence of instruction, meaning reveals itself as action. When your sponsor wants a guarantee, promise only what your edit can defend. For citizens, the Bunuel habit is a defense against a century whose illusions are both louder and cheaper than the 1930s. When you feel your attention dragged toward a spectacle, ask what meal is being delayed. When you feel a room becoming obedient to a symbol, ask who gains by postponing dinner. When you witness power using ritual to dissolve responsibility, remember that you can step out of the room like the servants by obeying an older rule than the invitation letter quotes. The older rule is neighborliness. It breaks most enchantments on contact. He aged without surrendering mischief. The bourbon glass stayed small. The suit stayed plain. The anecdotes grew more precise. At the end, he imagined a contraption that would let him dream on demand and then laugh at the arrogance of the wish. He died in 1983 in Mexico City with a body of work that made students of dinner guests. People called him a nihilist. He is anything but. His films insist that meaning is a stubborn weed. You will find it in courtyards where priests smoke, in cheap apartments where mothers make rice, in chambers where judges adjust their cuffs, in beds where women have decided to regard their desires with respect. The images that shock, the eye, the ants, the bomb, survive because they are caretakers for more delicate truths. Without an eye pried open, the smaller lights would go unnoticed. If you want to try him at home, don't start by slicing any eyes. Start by refusing one ritual that makes your day stupider. Start by carrying a notebook for a week and writing down one moment each day when you felt a room wanting to be honest but choosing a custom. Start by staging one dinner where phones cannot cross the threshold. Start by letting a silence finish its sentence. Start by apologizing without adjectives. Start by allowing a dream to correct tomorrow morning's plan rather than be corrected by it. Bunuel will not give you comfort for this. He will give you company. His movies make you less lonely for having noticed what you noticed long ago and were taught to disbelieve. He changed how we see the world by insisting that our habits are not harmless and that our desires are not criminal, by proving that images, properly arranged, can tell truths the pulpit and the podium have rehearsed too long to deliver, by inventing a cinema where dinner is always almost served, not to starve us, but to teach us what we are like when appetite and manners shake hands. When the guests finally walk again, it is not freedom that delights. Freedom is only the absence of a lock. It is the absurd kindness of bread. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World.